Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. If evolution has occurred, as millions of Americans believe, why are there no philosophical arguments which reach that conclusion? There are a number of influential philosophers who give wholehearted allegiance to the evolutionary hypothesis, but they have not, and by the very nature of the case, cannot formulate arguments which sustain their beliefs. Genuine philosophy does not just deal with the wild blue yonder. It must have facts, ideas, and concepts in order to be able to draw inferences or conclusions which are meaningful. The evolutionary theory does not have the data on which to build a valid worldview. If evolution has occurred, why do not the scriptures provide some insights into the process? Every Bible student knows that the doctrine of evolution, whether theistic or organic, contradicts the Word of God. Since there are ample evidences to establish the Bible as the Word of God, and no evidences for evolution, which makes more sense to you? Creation or evolution? God or the gorilla? Chance or Christ? Creation and evolution cannot be harmonized, regardless of what modernistic theologians may say to the contrary. If evolution has occurred, why have not scientists been able to furnish grounds for their beliefs? While many non-scientists believe evolution has been proved, many scientists, in fact most scientists, know better. The scientists may believe evolution, just as non-scientists do. But they know there are no knockdown arguments which absolutely demonstrate the factuality of evolution. Dr. Henry Morris's book, The Long War Against God, quotes Dr. Wolfgang Smith, a Roman Catholic scholar, as saying, "The fact remains that there exists to this day not a shred of bona fide scientific evidence in support of the thesis that macroevolutionary transformations have ever occurred." Page 129. By macroevolutionary transformations, Dr. Smith refers to significant changes, not minor variations, in the evolutionary chain. The single greatest book on evolution I have had the privilege of reading is Dr. Michael Denton's challenging book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. Dr. Denton is an Australian physician and research scientist, and probably an evolutionist of some sort. One paragraph from Dr. Denton's book will show that scientists and philosophers, including Charles Darwin, have had tremendous difficulty in trying to prove evolution. "There is no doubt," says Dr. Denton, "that as far as his macro-evolutionary claims were concerned, Darwin's central problem in the origin of species lay in the fact that he had absolutely no direct empirical evidence in the existence of clear-cut intermediates that evolution on a major scale had occurred, and that any major divisions of nature had been crossed gradually through a sequence of transitional forms. Over and over he returns to the same problem, confessing that the distinctness of specific forms are there not being blended together by innumerable transitional links is a very obvious difficulty." Page 56. But do not fossils provide those transitional links, or missing links, as they're called in popular speech? In other words, do not fossils prove evolution? Have not your teachers in biology, zoology, embryology, physiology, and even in theology told you for years that fossils definitely establish the truthfulness of evolution? Is it possible your teachers have been wrong about this matter? Please listen carefully to today's question for discussion. Do fossils prove evolution? Perhaps some definitions are in order at this time. Webster's Third New International Dictionary defines the word fossil as follows: any remains, impressions, or traces of an animal or plant of past geological ages that has been preserved in the earth's crust. Since I shall be talking of the work which paleontologists do, I would like to define the word paleontologist. A paleontologist is one who examines, classifies, and attempts to draw conclusions about the fossils which are found in various places. A paleontologist need not be an evolutionist, but apparently most of the influential ones are. It is not an exaggeration to say that billions and billions of fossils are found on every continent, in every country, and in almost every community. Museums in every major city across America and in every university house an enormous number of fossils. It has been my pleasure to visit the Museum of Natural History in Chicago. At the time I made the visit there many years ago, it was known as Field Museum. At Selmer, Tennessee, a rich find of fossils was made in recent years. Scientists from several universities and colleges have visited the site of the fossil discovery at Selmer. Many of the scientists who examined the fossils have spoken of the age of the fossils in terms of hundreds of millions of years, but they have been speculating. There are no measuring devices, including carbon-14 dating, which would sustain the guesses of these scientists. Paleontologists have been accused of reasoning in a circle with respect to the age of fossils. The story goes somewhat as follows. If you ask a paleontologist or a geologist how he knows how old certain fossils are, he will tell you their age based on the strata in which they were found. When you ask him how he knows how old the strata are, he will tell you that certain fossils are found in that strata. The truth is, no one knows how old the fossils are, nor does anyone know how old the strata are. Geologists and paleontologists have built up a framework which has no foundation. But the problem goes much deeper than that. There are no transitional forms or missing links to date. There may be old fossils and old strata, but there are no missing links. No missing links. Before I show you what the fossils are supposed to prove and what they actually do prove, let me give you some indication of just how important our topic is. Dr. Dwayne Gish holds a Ph.D. in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley and has written extensively for many years on the fossil record. He has also debated evolutionists throughout the world and is one of the most respected creationists in our country. Dr. Gish's 1985 book, Evolution, The Challenge of the Fossil Record, quotes these words from W. LeGros Clark, a well-known British evolutionist. That evolution did occur can only be scientifically established by the discovery of the fossilized remains of representative samples of those intermediate types which have been postulated on the basis of the indirect evidence for evolution, must be provided by the paleontologist whose business it is to study the evidence of the fossil record. Page 27. Two comments on Clark's opinion are in order. First, Dr. Clark unquestionably rests his case for evolution on the discovery of the fossilized remains of representative samples of intermediate types, or as we would call them today, missing links. If the transitional links cannot be found or do not exist, then there is no way of proving evolution. Second, Clark sees the work of paleontologists as being indispensable to the cause of evolution. Clark is saying, as evolutionists generally do, that the present is the key to the past. In other words, a careful examination of existing fossils should give us the information to understand what actually happened in the millions and millions of years of the human race's existence and development. But what in fact do the fossils prove? Where better can we begin than these words from Charles Darwin? Dr. Michael Denton quotes these words from Darwin's book, the origin of species. By the theory of natural selection, all living species have been connected with parent species of each genus. But differences not greater than we see between the natural and domestic varieties of the same species at the present day. That these parent species, now generally extinct, have in their turn been similarly connected with more ancient forms, and so on backwards, always converging to the common ancestor of each great class. So that the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory is true, such have lived upon the earth. Page 172. Let me make a few comments on this excerpt from Darwin's Origin of Species. First, Darwin fully trusted, though blindly, may I add, that fossils would eventually establish evolution. By Darwin's day, thousands and thousands of fossils had been found and had been studied by anthropologists and by other scientists. He believed an inconceivably great number of intermediate and transitional links of living and extinct species had existed and would be found in the coming years. But my friends, the truth is, millions and millions of fossils have been discovered since Darwin's day. But evolutionists are no nearer to proving evolution than they were then. In fact, there seem to be more evolutionists disputing certain assured results of scientific inquiry with respect to evolution than at any other time since Darwin's day. Second, Darwin was observant enough to know that living species are connected immediately to the parent species. A cat in Darwin's day looked just like its predecessor. A dog was still a dog as far back as history of the species went. In other words, like produced like, just as the Bible says. And God created the great whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Genesis 1:21. Darwin knew the variations between the parent species and the present species were imperceptibly small, if indeed they existed at all. The variations from one generation of plants or animals to another were so small that it would require an inconceivably great number to show that evolution had occurred. Since Darwin's day, have the missing links been discovered? If the evolutionary theory were going to stand the scrutiny of men of science, then untold millions of missing links would have to be found. So said the modern father of organic evolution. Unfortunately, from an evolutionary viewpoint, the missing links are still missing. Dr. Robert L. Dorrit of Harvard University, Dr. Warren F. Walker, Jr., Professor Emeritus of Oberlin College, and Dr. Robert D. Barnes of Gettysburg College have written a very impressive textbook on zoology. These authors make it very plain in the introduction to their textbook that they firmly believe in the theory of evolution. Please listen carefully to their confession of faith. Evolution, the notion that all animals are a part of a single genealogical network, and that descent with modification is a sufficient explanation for the shape of the living world, forms the conceptual core of this book. Without the golden thread of evolutionary theory, the animal world cannot be truly understood. Is there any doubt in your mind that these men completely reject the Bible and creation? What do these authors have to say about the fossil record? Do they believe the fossils prove evolution? By 1850, these distinguished scientists say, European paleontologists had unearthed, analyzed, and classified a vast number of invertebrate and vertebrate fossils, and had already discovered a number of patterns in the fossil record. Darwin was well acquainted with the paleontological literature. He was clearly aware that the fossil record did not show an imperceptibly slow, gradual progression of forms. Instead, the pattern consisted of the sudden appearance in geological time of new species, relatively long periods of stasis, or balance of state, where the species showed little or no morphological change, and the sudden appearance of species frequently coinciding with the arrival of yet another recognizably different form. Page 175. Charles Darwin had not found, nor has anyone else found to date, an imperceptibly slow, gradual progression of forms. What he did find was the sudden appearance in the geological strata of new species with relatively long periods of stability. What Darwin found had been recorded in the book of Genesis thousands of years before. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle of the earth after their kind, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Genesis 1:25. The fossil record and the Genesis record point to the same conclusion. Like produces like, and always has. God made it that way. Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. Gary Parker, both noted scientists and educators, as well as former evolutionists, who have become convinced creationists based on the scientific evidence, wrote a book in 1982 with the title, What is Creation Science? Dr. Morris and Dr. Parker discuss at some length the qualifications of Dr. David Raup of the Museum of Natural History in Chicago. That museum has 20% of all the fossil species known. So Dr. Raup ought to be able to speak with great authority on the relationship of fossils to evolution. These are the director's words. Well, we are now about 120 years after Darwin, and knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. Ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. By this I mean that some of the classic cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. Page 97. If evolution really has occurred, where are those missing links which Darwin believed would be found, and for which many modern anthropologists, biologists, and zoologists are still enthusiastically, and at this point, desperately searching? The evolutionists have no transitional forms or missing links, but they do offer some which have been publicized in college textbooks and in other places as proving evolution. One of the standard answers to the creationist request for missing links in the evolutionary chain is a fossil of Archaeopteryx. Dr. Morris and Dr. Parker describe this most unusual fossil. At first, you wonder what the fuss is all about. It has feathers, wings, and a beak, so it's a bird. But look a little closer. It has teeth in the bill, claws on the wings, no breastbone with a keel, an unfused backbone, and a long, bony tail. These are characteristics we normally associate with reptiles. What's more, the existence of a creature like Archaeopteryx was predicted by evolutionists before any such specimen was found. What's a creationist to say to a perfect example of evolution like Archaeopteryx? Page 101. Dr. Michael Denton gives an excellent answer to the question raised by Dr. Morris and Dr. Parker. This primitive bird did indeed possess certain skeletal reptilian features, teeth, a long tail, claws on its wings. However, in one respect, flight, the most characteristic feature of birds, Archaeopteryx was already truly a bird. On its wing there were flight feathers as fully developed as on any modern bird. And recent research reported in 1979 suggests that it was as capable of powerful flight as a modern bird. Page 175. Another so-called perfect example of an evolutionary intermediate form is the Rhipodistian fish. This ancient fish is supposed to furnish the ideal link between fish and the terrestrial vertebrates. Vertebrates, as you recall, are animals with spinal columns. This remarkable species of fish was supposed to exist in fossil form only. But in 1938, Dr. Denton says, fishermen in the Indian Ocean of Cape Province in South Africa hauled to the surface a living relative of the ancient Ripidistia, the coelacanth. It was an astonishing discovery, as the coelacanth had been thought to be extinct for 100 million years. Page 179. The discovery of this remarkable specimen provided a wonderful opportunity for modern scientists to examine what Dr. Denton calls one of the classic evolutionary links. And just what was the conclusion after the examination? It did not prove what evolutionists had been arguing for years. It was very, very disappointing. But how could it be disappointing if the scientists were looking for the truth and not just to confirm their support of evolution and their opposition to creationism? This whole incident involving the Ripidistian fish proves beyond any question that the scientists were unable to find a link between the fish and terrestrial vertebrates. I have one final point I need to emphasize briefly before our lesson closes. How do evolutionists explain the gaps in the fossil record? Evolutionists since the days of Charles Darwin recognized that gaps in the fossil record existed, and they have searched diligently for transitional forms. How do they explain the missing links? Why have they not been found? Dr. Michael Denton lists three most common explanations which evolutionists generally offer. First, the searches for fossils have been inadequate. This explanation makes no sense at all. Since the days of Charles Darwin, there have been hundreds of thousands of man-hours spent in searching all over the earth for missing links. The search has been so intense that some researchers have altered evidence to prove their atheistic theories. In 1955, J.S. Weiner wrote a book on the Piltdown forgery. Incidentally, Dr. Weiner is an evolutionist who says emphatically that man's origins are no longer in doubt. He firmly believed man came from a simian, that is, monkey status, to his present form of capability. Page 205. Dr. Weiner gives us the essential features of the Piltdown hoax. On 18 December of 1912, Arthur Smith Woodward and Charles Dawson announced to a great and expected scientific audience the epoch-making discovery of a remote ancestral form of man, the Dawn Man of Piltdown. Page 1. Many in the scientific community hail the Piltdown Man as a veritable confirmation of the evolutionary hypothesis. Sir Arthur Keith, a distinguished British scientist, explained the significance of the Piltdown Man. That we should discover such a race as Piltdown, sooner or later, has been an article of faith in the anthropologist's creed ever since Darwin's time. Page 6. I hope you notice Sir Arthur Keith's use of the expression, article of faith. That is precisely what evolution was in Darwin's day, in Sir Arthur Keith's day, and in our day. But the Piltdown Man was a forgery, a deliberate attempt to deceive the public and the scientific community into believing evolution. What motivates a scientist to alter evidence to prove his pet theories? Could it be that he does not like to retain God in his knowledge? Romans 1:28. Paul's assessment of the situation is very plain. Professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. Romans 1:22. Dr. Denton says that many evolutionists explain the gap in the fossil record by arguing for the imperfection of the record. For example, soft-bodied animals simply decayed and nothing was left to make fossils. But the truth is, there is no positive evidence for transitional forms. What we know about the fossil remains of plants and animals is that they were highly complex in their very earliest known forms. There is no hard evidence for evolutionary development. The final explanation for missing links in the chain of evolution is saltationism. Dr. Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard denies the gradualism of Darwinism and argues for the sudden appearance of new species. I cannot go further today with a discussion of saltationism, but Gould's theory is no more true or reasonable than Darwin's. They are both attempts to deny the truth of Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Evolutionists have given us nothing, nor can they, to refute this fundamental truth. My friends, we thank you for listening today. Please listen again at the very next time. May God bless you.